Sarah Palin, meet America. America, meet Sarah Palin.
I love those hockey moms. You know, they say the difference between a hockey mom and a pit bull? Lipstick.
After last night, she's the mother of all hockey moms. The question now is, could she end up as vice president? After a slow start, more than a few peak moments at the Republican National Convention, McPalin. That's the ticket. It's the takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, September 4th. Good morning, John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Adora.
And today, Republicans in St. Paul are waking up feeling pretty excited after a rousing night at their convention. We'll go to St. Paul for that. And a look at the city hosting the event. Also, the Lucifer effect. You know what that is?
It sounds evil.
It's about turning bad tendencies into good ones. We'll look at heroes today and predictions. Some people just get it right all the time. We'll explain that too, those stories and more. But first, these headlines.
It was a parade of former presidential candidates who took the stage at the Republican National Convention last night to rail on Barack Obama. Delegates heard from Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee, and Rudy Giuliani.
He's never run a city, he's never run a state, he's never run a business, he's never run a military unit, he's never had to lead people in crisis.
But it was the current vice presidential candidate who stole the show. Sarah Palin ripped into Obama in her speech.
I guess a small town mayor is sort of like a community organizer, except that you have actual responsibilities.
John McCain, looking very proud, made a surprise appearance after the speech and said he'd picked the right woman for the job.
Vice President Dick Cheney arrived in Georgia today, vowing the U.S. would stand by the former Soviet Republic in the face of recent Russian aggression. And the Georgians are getting more than just words. The Bush administration announced $1 billion in aid for the country. The Kremlin is condemning U.S. involvement with its defiant neighbor. Hurricane Hanna slammed Haiti with torrents of rain. Parts of the country are under several feet of water. Helicopters are rescuing people from rooftops. Now Hanna could be heading toward the Carolinas, where authorities say they could issue an evacuation order in just hours from now.
Other storm news, it could take a month to get the power back on in New Orleans after Hurricane Gustav. In Detroit, Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick goes back to court this morning. He's going to enter a plea that is presumed to force him to leave office. Oil prices holding steady in Asian trading above $109 a barrel. The Dow closed up slightly yesterday. The S&P is set to open at 1274. Sarah Palin introduced herself to the country last night. We want to hear from you. Here's what one of you had to say.
My name is Audrey from New Hampshire. I think Sarah Palin did an incredible job on her speech. And my concern is I don't know that the U.S. needs a pit bull for a vice president.
Well, they may get
one. But that's an interesting question to take from that speech. Thank you so much, Audrey. And we want to hear what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Lots of opinions so far, John.
We asked you about Barack Obama last week. This could be the peak moment of the Republican National Convention, although John McCain speaks tonight. We want to know what you think about Sarah Palin. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Vice President Pitbull. Do we need one?
I don't know. Some people probably think we do, and some don't think so. We'll see. 877-8 my take.
Pitbull would want to be president.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This morning, there are some very happy Republicans following VP nominee Sarah Palin's speech last night on the floor at the convention hall in St. Paul. It was her first major speech, her first time addressing the delegates, and the first time many Americans have ever heard her. But Not before her speech came, I should say, after a few warm-up speeches, including former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who certainly launched his own assaults. And Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein was there watching it all from the floor. And Andrea, boy, Giuliani, he certainly went for it last night.
Yes, he warmed up the crowd, and to those of us who've watched Giuliani's career for some time, there's nothing that he loves more than a good punch, and he was punching last night. He was striking out at Barack Obama. He was having a great time. He went off script. He went over time, and he was using his own biography to mock Barack Obama, saying things like, "When has he ever stood up in a crisis?"
Not a personal attack, a statement of fact. Barack Obama has never led anything, nothing, nada.
So really a preview, Andrea, there of the GOP strategy against Obama and Biden.
That's right. And there was a lot of mocking of Obama's community organizing in Chicago by both Giuliani and later by vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin. David Plouffe, Barack Obama's campaign manager, has already sent out a response to that early this morning to Barack Obama supporters saying, look, they're mocking you. Community organizing is the way we change Washington. But Giuliani really rocked the crowd. There had been two kind of lackluster speeches, one by Mitt Romney, who I've heard him give some excellent speeches, but this one sounded like it was from a different decade. Very us and them, very much talking about the Washington liberal establishment. Then Huckabee came out, and he gave a speech. But when Giuliani came out, the crowd just stood, and they roared, and they wouldn't let him speak. And he did this thing where he sort of tried to make it suggest that the Republicans are the grassroots people and the Democrats, I mean, Barack Obama, son of a single mother, part of his life he was on food stamps, but to this crowd, it's Barack Obama who's the elitist.
I'm sorry that Barack Obama feels that her hometown isn't cosmopolitan enough. I'm sorry, Barack, that it's not flashy enough. Maybe they cling to religion there.
Andrea, it's always so interesting to watch, and both parties do this, sort of the spin unfolding, because I don't think Barack Obama has been directly critical of Sarah Palin to date. It's been Democratic members or other people.
Well, that's right. As a matter of fact, the Democratic Party's been very light on Sarah Palin. If anything, the criticism has come from the media. But there was this conflation last night between what John McCain used to refer to as his base, a.k.a. the media, not the people in the hall here, who in fact are the Republican base, and the Democratic Party. And both Rudy Giuliani and the other speakers were suggesting that somehow the media and the Democrats were in this cabal to go after Sarah Palin.
Well, I don't know if the Democrats have been light on Sarah Palin. I mean, they were certainly talking about experiences off the table now because of her. So I don't know if I buy that. But I do think that the tone of this convention has, and you sort of alluded to it a moment ago, they've turned the tables on the Democrats in a sense. You know, all these hand-painted speeches, it seems very folksy there in St. Paul, and it makes Denver look almost corporate, and the elitist charge suddenly seems to stick.
That's right, and that's by design. And when Sarah Palin came out last night, she introduced the five members of her family, and she talked about being the mayor of a small town. And then she invoked Harry Truman in talking about the sincerity of small town people.
They're the ones who do some of the hardest work in America, who grow our food and run our factories and fight our wars. They love their country in good times and bad, and they're always proud of America.
Some of the criticisms that she's faced, it sounds like Sarah Palin last night took them one by one, including the notion that she's got no foreign policy experience.
That's right. And she began to talk about the war in Iraq in a very offensive way. And it's interesting because Republicans have been sort of muted on the war, and they were through much of the primary season. But last night they came out swinging and painted the war as if almost as if it was a throwback to 2004, when the argument of the Bush campaign was, we have the strategy that will protect our nation. The Democrats have the weak strategy. Here is Sarah Palin talking about Barack Obama.
Victory in Iraq is finally in sight, and he wants to forfeit. Terrorist states are seeking nuclear weapons without delay. He wants to meet them without preconditions. Al-Qaeda terrorists still plot to inflict catastrophic harm on America, and he's worried that someone won't read them their rights.
Well, there's one check for her. The other thing is about how much experience she has. There's been lots of questions and lots of talk and lots of reaction from the Republicans who say she's plenty experienced. But we actually heard her address that issue last night.
That's right. She starts talking about the closest nation to Alaska, which is, of course, Russia.
With Russia wanting to control a vital pipeline in the Caucasus and to divide and intimidate our European allies by using energy as a weapon, we cannot leave ourselves at the mercy of foreign suppliers.
And she does this very interesting thing now. There's been this sort of theme all night, the drill, baby, drill. One Republican said to me, oh, I thought we weren't supposed to say drill. We were supposed to say explore. But this became a theme of the night, that Republicans support offshore drilling, that drilling is the right thing to do. And she goes from this sort of sweeping foreign policy statement to linking it right down to her Alaska roots.
Americans, we need to produce more of our own oil and gas and take it from a gal who knows the North Slope of Alaska. We've got lots of both.
A gal. And she can pronounce nuclear, too. Did you hear that?
Yeah,
that's a headline.
She said that quite well. But it sounds like, Andrea, that there was almost a collective sigh of relief in the midst of all that clapping, that Sarah Palin stood up and she delivered on what many Republicans thought were points that she needed to make forcefully and clearly.
Absolutely. There was one delegate who said to me last night, I said, are you nervous before the speech? And he said, well, I'm looking at this as if I would the birth of a child. It's going to be a great event, but I hope it all goes well. And afterwards, people were sort of roaring. They were shouting. They were crying USA. They were saying, hit it out of the ballpark. They were waving their flags. And she wraps up the speech by doing, you know, what vice presidential candidates are supposed to do, which is sort of vouch for the presidential candidate, but in a way in which she links the central Republican argument about John McCain, that he's an honorable man, to the sort of small-town person that she is.
It's the journey of an upright and honorable man, the kind of fellow whose name you will find on war memorials in small towns across this great country, only he was among those who came home.
I think John just referred to this, but this gal language and fellow language, it does all sound very folksy.
Right. And McCain came up on stage and did just one line saying, yeah, what was I right, huh? I mean, he was pretty proud looking. What does he have to do tonight? I mean, in some ways, he wouldn't want to follow this. Does he have to top her?
Well, I think that the big drama was last night because people had never seen her. They didn't know how she would do. And, you know, we have yet to see how she's going to play in Peoria and whether this red meat that she was throwing out is something that the rest of the nation wants to hear. But what John McCain needs to do is cap it all off. And, you know, one Republican last night when Sarah Palin and Rudy Giuliani began to attack the Republican Party and say, we've distinguished ourselves, I said, well, how does that make you feel as a Republican? Isn't this the base of the Republican Party? And he said, oh, she must be referring to other elements of the Republican Party. So that's the task of John McCain for tonight, is to be able to talk against the Republicans while rousing the Republicans in the hall.
Andrea Bernstein, many thanks again for bringing a whole lot of clarity to us here at The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, The Takeaway's political director, reporting to us from St. Paul. She'll be back tomorrow morning with more, and here's what one of you thought.
This is David Alexander in Queens. She compared herself to a pit bull with lipstick. There's not much difference between the two, is there? We have to be very careful to see through this cheering, cheerful, strong image and look at what they're standing for.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
After your nation won its freedom in the Rose Revolution, America came to the aid of this courageous young democracy. We are doing so again as you work to overcome an invasion of your sovereign territory and an illegitimate, unilateral attempt to change your country's borders by force that has been universally condemned by the free world.
That's Vice President Dick Cheney in the Republic of Georgia today, condemning Russia for what he said was an illegitimate attempt to change Georgia's borders by force. Also, Cheney promised U.S. support to rebuild the former Soviet nation, and this comes a day after the White House announced a billion-dollar aid package to Georgia following its clash with Russia last month. Jonathan Marcus is the BBC's diplomatic correspondent. He joins us from London. Good morning, Jonathan. So, essentially, the U.S. is backing up its words of support with $1 billion. Practically speaking, how significant is this?
I think it's significant. It's a large sum of money, obviously. There is a pressing need. The money is going to go on things like resettling refugees, rebuilding a lot of Georgia's infrastructure, which has been destroyed quite deliberately in some cases by the Russian forces when they were in the country. Obviously, the Russian forces are not wholly left yet, and that's a pressing problem. I think one of the more interesting things is the U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, when she was announcing this package yesterday, stressed that she hoped that this would be a continuing relationship of aid, that it would be a package that would be backed by whoever comes into the White House next year. And I think that message of continuing support for Georgia from the United States is clearly a message that Washington wants to be heard very loud and clear in Moscow.
And Cheney certainly threw a barb in there where he called Russia's attempt to change the borders of Georgia illegitimate.
Indeed, Bob. The trouble is, of course, that by and large, the West's reaction to Russia's actions in Georgia has largely been rhetorical. It's largely been words. Yes, there has been support diplomatically. Yes, there has been practical support in the terms of finance and money and so on. But practically, the Russians still seem to retain the whip hand. Their forces are still inside parts of Georgia. They have obviously accepted the independence, recognized the independence of these two separatist regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. I think most people you speak to have no doubt that those two areas are not going to go back to Georgian control anytime soon, if ever, in fact. So the West, in a sense, has few practical levers it can pull. I think one of the more interesting things that was not in this latest aid package for Georgia is the question of military support. Obviously, when NATO ministers met a few weeks ago, there was talk about the need to rebuild Georgia's military infrastructure, to rearm and so on. I think that is really going to be the thing that causes problems with Moscow. So far, the Americans haven't yet made clear what plans they have to help rebuild Georgia's shattered military.
But that certainly hasn't stopped Russia from accusing the United States from helping Georgia to rearm through aid shipments.
That's true. Again, there's a lot of rhetoric on the Russian side. I don't think there's any particular evidence at all that these naval vessels or the Coast Guard vessel involved have been supplying arms. All the evidence suggests they were indeed doing, as the Americans said, supplying humanitarian aid. Clearly, the fact that the Americans have put these ships into the Black Sea is interesting. That's a kind of signal in itself to the Russians that the Russians shouldn't solely regard this as they do as their own backyard. But, you know, given the location of Georgia, given the proximity to Russia, given the balance of forces in the region, it's very hard to see in practical terms what more the Americans can do.
Well, Jonathan, let's explore that a little bit. I mean, on the one hand, is it possible, or as a diplomatic correspondent, what is the likelihood that behind closed doors, Saakashvili said to Cheney, you know, thanks so much for your infrastructure support, but, you know, I'd really like the tanks. And on the Russian side, is it possible they're looking for some sort of pretext here, that if they detect even the smallest evidence of arms coming in, that they're going to escalate on their side?
Well, I think this round of fighting is over for now, and I think the Russians have pretty well got what they wanted. As far as the Europeans are concerned, they genuinely thought the Russians were on the road to Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, and to that extent, you know, while the French initiative to halt the fighting has been criticized in many quarters as having been threadbare and not having been thought through sufficiently, it's no doubt the Russians have driven a coach and horses through it. The fact is that it did halt the fighting, and you know, perhaps this could have led to you know, a takeover of the Georgian capital and the overthrow by force of President Saakashvili's government. Now, as far as the Americans and arms sales go, I think there is no doubt that there will be American arms sales. There will be maybe arms sales from other Western countries. The problem, of course, is to calibrate what it is that Georgia requires. The emphasis will clearly be on defensive weapons. Up to now, most of the American support has been directed at training and equipping the Georgian forces who have been operating, for example, in Iraq alongside U.S. forces.
And Jonathan, how closely do you understand the U.S. and Europe to be coordinating in their response to what's gone on in Russia and Georgia the past month?
Well, there's close coordination, but there are clearly very significant differences in their appraisal of the situation. It's not really simply a Europe versus the United States argument. There are a number of countries in Europe, Britain to a large extent, Poland, the Baltic republics, who really want quite a tough line towards Russia. They echo to an extent the sorts of views that we're hearing from Vice President Dick Cheney and from other spokespeople in the United States. There are other European countries who are more, if you like, in the center, the French,
right.
The Germans a little uneasy, some who take a much softer view towards Russia, the Italians, some of the southern European countries.
Jonathan Marcus, thank you. Jonathan is the BBC diplomatic correspondent. And now we're going to turn to Femi Oke, who is the news correspondent. She's got lots of news, the latest news. Femi?
Thank you very much. I might even have some news for you. 20. Don't think we said news enough in that last 30 seconds. 28 and a half minutes past the hour.
This would be the news part coming up right here.
And I have some news for you. Good morning. At the Republican National Convention yesterday, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin delivered a speech that gave a folksy glow to her small town background, but also blasted Barack Obama. John McCain's little-known running mate got cheers and a standing ovation with her digs at the Democrats. Vice President Dick Cheney has arrived in the Republic of Georgia today. Cheney offered U.S. support to the region in the face of recent Russian aggression. His visit comes just a day after the White House announced $1 billion in aid for the country. Cheney heads to Ukraine later today. Hurricane Hanna slammed Haiti with torrents of rain. Parts of the country are under several feet of water, and people are actually standing on their rooftops to escape the flooding. The storm could be heading to the United States. The southeast coast is bracing for a hit, and South Carolina authorities say they could issue evacuation orders today. And just behind Hanna, we have a major Hurricane Ike. We'll see where that will go in a few days' time.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online, or if that's an invasion of their child's privacy. Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Reaction flooding in to the Palin speech last night at the Republican convention. Republicans have no more substance to offer than personal attacks on their opponents in the form of cheap jokes and laugh lines. At the convention in Denver, every speaker went out of their way to distinguish between the personal respect for John McCain and directing their criticism toward his policies. They seem, the Republicans, unable to offer the same courtesy to their opponents. That's from the Nice Guys Finish Last School. We're also talking about heroes and whether we need more of them. Do you have a story of everyday heroism? Do you think we're a nation
John,
in need of more heroes?
John, you're my hero. You're my hero.
Thank you.
I just thought I would share.
John from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. My wife was a history editor at one time. She said America is now taught to be not a melting pot, but stir fry. When you're melded in with everybody and part of something bigger than yourself, you feel anything you do means something to the greater good of all. And I think that's why heroic acts would happen more when we're seen as one large community.
An intriguing and optimistic thought. Tell us your story of heroism, 877-8-MY-TAKE. And what would it take to get more heroes in the world? And how close are human beings to behaving in a fundamentally evil way?
It's a fascinating question. What does it take?
A long-standing question. And psychologist Philip Zimbardo took a look at this with his famous Stanford prison experiment. You remember when students were given power over other students and they took it to extremes? They even surprised Professor Zimbardo back when he did that experiment. Well, now he's turned his attention to the impulse to be a hero. It's a new project called the Heroic Imagination Project. And Dr. Zimbardo joins us now. He's a retired professor at Stanford University. Dr. Zimbardo, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John.
Now, your most recent work focuses on heroes, and I want you to explain it to me, because in reading some of your work, it seems that on the one hand, people regard acts of heroism as kind of ordinary, yet they still are rare. What's going on here?
Well, the reason I'm focusing on heroism now, away from my lifelong fascination with evil, is that heroism is really the most important antidote any society has to evil. That what I'm trying to promote is the notion that most heroes are ordinary people. It's the heroic act that's extraordinary. So heroism is relatively rare in a society, and I want to begin to change that. And by change that, I mean to develop courses from middle school on through college, through the media, to develop the notion that what's really critical is that we all have a heroic imagination. We think of ourselves as heroes in waiting, because a hero is somebody who acts on behalf of others, but only in certain situations. And those situations are relatively rare, situations of evil, situations of coming to defense of somebody in an emergency situation, like Wesley Autry did on the New York subway last year. But there's very little research on heroism. Surprisingly, there's a lot of research on violence, on evil, of mass murders. But psychologists and other social scientists have tended to ignore what's noble in the human character, namely heroism.
Well, let's talk a little bit about one of the things you have found. And the name of your new project is the Heroic Imagination Project. You sort of described it there a little bit. One of the things you've found is that what prevents people from acting heroically often is not that they're bad, but that they feel that they don't really have time. They're pressed for time, and that sort of keeps them from taking a step they might have taken.
Yeah, I mean, the other work that I've been doing, and I published a new book called The Time Paradox, is that because so much of our lives, especially New Yorkers, live in a time capsule, a time press, that because we're always focused on where we're going, we often don't stop to not only smell the roses, but to notice people in distress. And that there's been lots of research which shows that when not all ordinary people, and really good people, people like Princeton Theological Seminarians, are on the way to give a Good Samaritan sermon, and they pass somebody who is in need of their help, somebody in an alleyway, if they believe they are late for the sermon, 90% of the time they pass the guy by.
Wow.
Whereas if they have time, the same seminarians will stop to help.
So time pressure enforces a kind of selfishness which blinds you to people around you who might even be very obviously in need of help.
Well, it doesn't make you selfish. What it means is you're focusing on a distant target, and you lose perspective on the things all around you. So a hero is somebody who becomes, you know, I don't want to say street smart, situationally smart, that in any situation you go in, you immediately notice, for example, where the exits are. So if there's a fire and everybody runs for the exit they came in, you're in a position to tell people, no, use the other exit. So what we're trying to do is train children to self-label. If you think of yourself as a potential hero, the likelihood that when the time comes, when there is some emergency, you're going to be more likely to act that way.
Well, Doctor, how do you teach people that when they go into a room to not only look for the exits in case something bad happens, but to look for how they can be helpful?
Yeah, but see, that comes through family, that comes through schooling, that comes really through basic change in our culture, that we've been focused too much on individuals making it. Most heroes who are successful are part of a social network. Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, their success as individual heroes was always developing a network of people, of like-minded people, of people who are going to help. And so part of what we're trying to do in our heroic imagination courses, and we already have some up and running in Detroit, Michigan, headed by my colleague Matt Langdon, is you teach kids how to be prepared. You teach them social skills. How do you build a network of other kids? One of the worst evils that we all know about is bullying. Bullying not only hurts the kid who's bullied, but it changes the whole classroom atmosphere. And most people are not bullies, but they are passively, they are guilty of the evil of inaction. They look the other way. And so a heroic act is getting a bunch of kids to confront the bully and say, we don't like what you're doing, but if you stop, we'll be your friend. And if you don't stop, collectively, we will make your life miserable and we will bully you in a sense.
The network beats the bully. The social network beats the bully. Well, I have to say, the enthusiasm and excitement in your voice is infectious, and I wish you the best of luck on this project. And we want to check in as you proceed with the Heroic Imagination Project. Dr. Zimbardo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. We do have a wonderful website, everydayheroism.com. We have lots of research we've just starting to do, and I hope your listeners will tune in. Everydayheroism.com.
Dr. Philip Zimbardo, thank you. He's Professor Emeritus of Psychology at Stanford University, and you can go to our website for more information on his project and to check out our own hero reports at thetakeaway.org. Now, Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thanks, John. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin came out smiling and swinging last night as she took the stage at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. Palin confronted critics who called her a poor choice by McCain. 200,000 city residents are returning home to New Orleans after fleeing before Hurricane Gustave slammed into the Gulf Coast. But it may take several weeks to get the electricity back on in cities and towns along the Gulf Coast area. That's a quick look at your main headlines.
Thanks, fam.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. What must the people of St. Paul, Minnesota, be making of the Republicans in their midst all this week at the Republican National Convention? We go back to St. Paul now, where our team has been working the crowds both in the hall and out on the street, among them correspondent Faith Saley, whose mission is to get some reaction from luminaries in the midst of St. Paul. Faith, good morning.
Good morning, John. My mission yesterday was pretty simple. I wanted to find a real St. Paulian and just spend some time together, you know, learn about the Twin Cities. So have a listen. Perhaps you'll recognize him.
The number of Minnesotans who talk funny is shrinking.
Who's that?
Oh, gosh. Who is that? That's Noah Adams?
No, that's Melissa Block. Keeler.
That is
Garrison Keeler. And he spent some time with me and answered a few questions.
In Minnesota, we don't use the word Twin Cities. We just call them the cities, going back to the cities.
Is there a rivalry? If you live in St. Paul, do you think it's the prettier, smarter twin?
There is a sort of lighthearted rivalry, but it doesn't really make any sense since Minneapolis won a long time ago, and St. Paul is fine with that.
With St. Paul voting Democratic most of the time, what was the scuttlebutt around here when folks found out the RNC would be held here?
Oh, they were pleased, of course. They were honored, you know, really, really, you know, would seem to put us in the big leagues. Of course, we couldn't have attracted it on our own without Minneapolis.
What does Minnesota nice mean?
It has many facets. This is a place where people would feel an obligation to stop and help you if they felt that you needed help. If your car was stuck on the ice, if your car was in the ditch, if you were a woman on a highway and seemed to be out of gas, people would stop. If they didn't stop, they would feel painfully guilty for an hour afterward, maybe a half hour.
What does country first mean to you when you hear it?
Country first is an odd sort of Roman motto. I don't recognize it as American. We are by and large a God-fearing religious country, and to say country first, it just doesn't sound right. It's like using the word homeland. Homeland is not an American word.
Oh, and I should have asked this at the beginning. Will you tell me what your name is and where you're from?
My name is Carson Weiler, and I live right here in St. Paul. I have a home here. I'm a taxpayer in St. Paul.
Oh, John, Carson Weiler, such a nice fella.
He's a chucklehead, yeah.
What do you say? They won the popularity contest a long time ago, huh?
I'd like to put him in a ring with Sarah Palin. That'd be fun.
Yeah, Carson Weiler, Sarah Palin ticket. That might just do it.
That would be good, yeah. Worldwide wrestling. Thank you very much, Faith.
Okay, then. Thanks, Jen.
Faith Saley there in St. Paul for us on the takeaway. All right.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
If you're just waking up, it's Thursday and it's September 4th, and here are the latest headlines for you, and they're coming from Femi Oke. Hey, Femi.
Hello there. I'll be your alarm call as well. It is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Good morning. Part autobiography and part attack on Democratic challenger Barack Obama. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin's speech roused Republicans at the convention in St. Paul. Palin and other speakers, including former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, Mike Huckabee and Mitt Romney, praised John McCain and hit Obama with claims of inexperience. Vice President Dick Cheney has arrived in Georgia in a show of support for the embattled nation and its pro-Western president. Russia is unhappy with Cheney's visit and other rhetoric from Washington, and tensions could escalate if the U.S. helps Georgia rebuild its shattered military. Tropical storm Hannah got stronger overnight, and a hurricane watch is posted along the North and South Carolina coasts. Right now, the storm is taking aim at the central Bahamas. And out at sea, Hurricane Ike is also getting stronger. It's considered an extremely dangerous Category 4 storm. Angry Pakistani officials summoned U.S. Ambassador Ann Patterson to protect yesterday's raid by U.S. special forces on a Pakistani village along the Afghanistan border. U.S. and NATO troops are battling militants in tribal areas in the region. And that's a look at the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
Oh, boy, I bet you can guess what's coming now. Stephen Dubner, our co-author of the Freakonomics book and New York Times blog, joins us. He's just back from the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. So good morning to you, Stephen.
Good morning. You have to pay for these? You
got your own theme now?
What's
the deal? Who's your agent, dude?
Anyhow, we're going to move on to talking about things that you know best. Vice presidential picks, election outcomes. This is a year for betting people who just love predictions, right?
Yeah, I wanted
economists
to talk about...
might be among them, but there are some folks who take it a bit further than just friendly banter. They're just betting on everything, and they call it a market prediction, or
called
prediction market.
Prediction market is it's a catchphrase. Well, it's an umbrella phrase that talks about, as you said, these markets that try to predict the future. Now, the stock market is essentially a prediction market. We kind of know how that works. There's also gambling, which is, you know, bookmaking, which is a prediction market. You want to predict which horse is going to come in first. But
I mean, Lloyd's of London is kind of a prediction market,
well,
too. Insurance.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly right. So there's a huge history of people trying to make profit by predicting the future. No surprise there. What's happened in the last 8 or 10 years, however, is an academic or kind of wonky bent has come to the field where prediction markets are set up to try to gauge future events like political elections, okay? So there's a famous one, the Iowa Electronic Betting Market. That's not exactly the right name. Iowa Electronic Market, I guess, which is set up by political scientists. But now we have prediction markets where people can wage real money on political outcomes. So how this is interesting and different is this. Unlike the punditocracy, unlike polling, unlike most of the ways that we have to gather information about election outcomes, these use inside information and people can profit from it, okay? So it's different than the stock market where we forbid insider trading. This is trying to encourage the smartest information to come forward and to try to profit from it. Therefore, prediction markets have a better outcome of predicting future elections than just about any other measure.
Hmm. Didn't John Poindexter in the Bush administration get in trouble trying to set up a prediction market for terror?
Yeah, that was really interesting and wild. It didn't last long. It was DARPA set up a futures terrorism market, and the idea was exactly this. Let's make a market where people can profit by giving us good information that we can then profit from. But politically, that was a huge firebomb.
Let's get back to what you were talking about specifically. Are they accurate?
Yeah.
When you're talking about allowing all kinds of information, but clearly politics is far different than the market. Inside information in the market might, you know, have a greater percentage of predicting the outcome. But in a political campaign, opening up all of the information to this calculation, is it more reliable?
The short answer is yes. The short answer is compared to our current standards of polling and pundits, it is more reliable. Now, there are all kinds of limitations. Sometimes there's very low volume. InTrade is one of the big markets. It's set up in Dublin. InTrade, in fact, posted a couple days ago a contract on the likelihood that Sarah Palin would be removed from the ticket before the election.
It's down today, I bet.
It is down today, although not as significantly as you might think. But yeah, the highest it ever got was about a 20% chance that she would be removed. Then it plummeted. It's now hovering a little bit below 10. So not likely at all, but plainly, you know, 1 out of 10 people think that's so.
Well, what else did you do at the convention?
Well, I tried to, you know, talk to a lot of people about what kind of, if the prediction market is trying to figure out the future, one of the things you don't know is what kind of surprises can happen, right? So I did want to ask people, we know the classic October surprise we talk about with Reagan,
right.
Carter, and
the hostage situation.
Right.
Yeah.
So I asked people at the GOP convention, if you had a magic wand, these were mostly delegates I was asking, if you had a magic wand, you could wave it, produce any October surprise that you wanted that would guarantee that your candidate would win, what would it be? Here are their replies.
I guess if I could just take a wand and make it happen, I'd have something to do with the economy.
I would want the surprise to be the true worth of each candidate to really surface.
Well, that is such a creative question. That truly is. I don't think I've ever been asked about October surprise. I think the best surprise is no surprise.
I would love to see McCain elected on the issues and no surprises.
You are so creative, yes, Stephen,
right.
Dubner.
Yeah, big points for that, right? Yeah, yeah, that and
$4.50. We noticed that you kept that in. Yeah, we noticed that you kept that bit.
That was the producer kept it in, but
well,
thanks for noticing.
Speaking of prediction markets, we've had one of our own, the Veep Stakes, on our website, thetakeaway.org, and we have two winners now that the whole Veep thing has been settled. Alex Whipperman joins us from Waverly, Iowa, and Brett Edsel joins us from Xenia, Ohio. Alex, you won on what pick?
My choice for vice president was Joe Biden on the Dem side, and then I had Mitt Romney on the Republican side.
And Brent Edsel, what was your claim to fame?
Well, at first I came into it because I thought Sarah Palin would get chosen. In the end, I had all my money on Eric Cantor, though.
And the winning, though, for you is you made enormous amounts of money because you were betting what other people, you were staying ahead of what other people thought was going to be the outcome. But, Brent, in your case, you also actually at one point picked Sarah to be the VP.
That's right. I, from the beginning, I thought, well, she might not be the best qualified. She seemed like she was the best candidate in an election where it seemed like a woman needed to be on the ticket. None of the candidates had executive experience, and here she was a governor, and being in Alaska, she's sitting on so much oil and natural resources, it seemed like a natural.
Now, it's not real money that you won, but Alec, your portfolio of fake takeaway money, how did that appreciate?
Well, it did pretty good. It started out kind of slow, but it picked up as I slowly caught onto the trends in the market and did a better job of following along with the news and staying ahead of the game. Came up somewhere, I think, a little short of $3
trillion. $3 trillion. Nice work. You get the Lexus, Alec.
We'll send a check to you in the mail, Alec.
No,
Alec. That'd be appreciated.
Alec, are you better at inside information, or are you better at feeling your gut when you bet on these things?
I think I did a better job when I was keeping better track of the blogs and trying to stay ahead of you guys in terms of the stock price updates.
Brent, how about you? Gut or inside information? What's your secret?
A lot of it was inside information. and I would watch late-night news, and then I would run down to my computer and change my investments around.
So we really see in your victory here, in your precise experience, exactly what Dubner was saying over here, Dubby, our Freakonomics dude, that basically what the prediction market does is it takes information and refines it and sort of floats it to the top so that the prediction actually is pretty decent. What's your next step, guys, Alec and Brent?
Yeah, who are you picking on the tickets between Biden and Obama and Palin and McCain? Alec?
Well, I worked for Barack Obama in the Iowa caucuses, and I'm going to stick with him, so I'm going to back him there.
Brent, you want to try to predict Paris Hilton's husband?
I can't do that, but... I came at this as a Republican, and like I said, I had Palin from the start, so I think she's the Republican's Obama, and I think she's going to put McCain over the edge.
Wow. Alec Wipperman and Brent Edsel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I'd like to know what kind of October surprises these guys would predict, right? Because when you care a lot about a candidate, you think of the strengths, you think of the weaknesses, you know. So we solicited some replies from our blog readers since we got pretty bland replies from the GOP delegates. Not surprisingly. I mean, I wouldn't want to go on the record either. So, you know, McCain falling asleep during a debate
seems to be pretty pro
Obama.
Biden sex change operation? Anyone
well,
choose that?
Here's one that I like from our reader. There's a physical altercation at the debate between Biden and Palin, and she wins.
Ooh, Stephen Dubner, things to think about, author of the Freakonomics book and blog, just back from the Republican National Convention.
And lots of ways to catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, thetakeaway.org.
Martin reacts to the Palin speech by saying a thin voice and some bad jokes will not win the White House. We're also talking about heroes and Dick Cheney's visit to Georgia.
And, of course, you can join the conversation on our website at thetakeaway.org. I'm Adoree Doji.
And I'm John Huckaberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway. Freakonomics.
Barack Obama in a packed stadium in Denver. She's not impressed.
When the stadium lights go out and those styrofoam Greek columns are hauled back to some studio lot, when that happens, what exactly is our opponent's plan?
Alaska Governor Sarah Palin meets the Democrats' 84,000 in Denver and raises by one soccer mom. Republican poker in St. Paul. Read 'em and veep. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adoree Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Okay, John, that was clever. Read them and beep. I like that one. Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, September 4th, and good morning to you, John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Adora. Read them and beep.
Today, Republicans at their national convention are preparing for John McCain's acceptance speech, and they're quite happy with the job that his VP nominee, Sarah Palin, did last night on the floor in St. Paul. We go to St. Paul. We also talked to McCain's top economic advisor about market perception and those who analyze it. India and the U.S. and nuclear proliferation cause for some concern among some, and the new game Spore. It's a video game. You can build your own organism online. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Well, you heard it here. Sarah Palin, controversial and little-known vice presidential candidate. She's little-known no more. Fireworks in St. Paul in a speech that blasted Barack Obama.
I guess a small-town mayor is sort of like a community organizer, except that you have actual responsibilities.
Palin presented herself as a down-home, tough leader. John McCain made a surprise appearance. McCain accepts his party's nomination tonight. Vice President Dick Cheney arrived in the Republic of Georgia earlier today. Cheney offered U.S. support to the region in the face of the recent crisis with Russia.
Americans are acutely conscious of the great trials your country has faced over the last 4 weeks, and we stand in solidarity with the people of Georgia.
And U.S. taxpayers are ponying up $1 billion of solidarity with the people of Georgia. An aid package was announced just this morning by Condoleezza Rice.
In Haiti today, they are blaming Hurricane Hanna for 61 deaths. Hanna has also caused catastrophic flooding in Haiti. Parts of the country are under more than 6 feet of water. And now Hanna could be heading for the U.S. South Carolina could issue evacuation orders just hours from now. And another hurricane is waiting in the wings. Ike is hovering over the Atlantic. It's gaining strength and is now a Category 4 storm with winds up to 145 miles per hour.
New Orleans residents can finally go home, but most are not going to have power yet. Could take a month to turn it back on. Barack Obama holds a rally this evening in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. He's also going to be on Fox News' The O'Reilly Factor. And John McCain, of course, is at the Republican convention. Jobless claims jumped unexpectedly last week, up 15,000 to 444,000. Continued weakness in the labor markets. The S&P is set to open at 1274. Well, it's all Palin all the time.
Oh, yes. Yes, a huge sigh of relief, we're told, from Minnesota that she performed very well. People very excited there.
But who cares about them? We want to know what you think. You're actual voters. You're not a delegate. You're a voter. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with a review of the Palin speech. Any other comments you would care to make at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Here's a little news flash for those reporters and commentators. I'm not going to Washington to seek their good opinion. I'm going to Washington to serve the people of this great country.
That's Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin. And by many accounts, she rocked the House at the GOP convention last night in St. Paul. And she really saved her best insults for Barack Obama and those who question her experience. But still, many Americans know very little about Palin and what she has accomplished, except for Steve Heimel. He is a senior producer and an editor at Alaska Public Radio Network and the host of a weekly call-in show, Talk of Alaska, which takes the pulse of the people there. And you've been covering politics in Alaska for some time. Steve, what'd you think of her speech?
You know, we saw what they call a Saracuda. She was called the Saracuda when she played basketball, and she was far more aggressive than I've ever seen her in a public speaking role last night.
And she certainly covered a whole lot of ground. I mean, one of the questions and some criticism about her announcement has been about her experience as a mayor of a town, Wasilla, of 9,800 people. She went on to talk about how that is real experience and confronted some of that criticism.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I mean, you know, there was one line in there that was worthy of Pat Buchanan, where she's talking about, you know, we got terrorists threatening us, and he's worried someone won't read them their rights. Man, that's a real attack line there.
So let's talk about her experience as mayor of that town. She served two terms, and we're talking she oversaw somewhere around, what, 50 employees with a $6 million budget?
Yeah, it's... Wasilla is essentially a similar to suburbs you would see all over the United States, and it's kind of a suburb of Anchorage. It doesn't have an industrial base. It's strung along a highway with lots of strip malls. It's kind of a Bible Belt on steroids as a community, and yeah, it's got the kind of government problems that any suburban area that's experiencing fast growth, like you know, around Nashville or Atlanta, has, and so it's you know, it is a challenge to govern.
And according to some reports, and a lot of this is just filtering out slowly because we're not even at a week since she's been announced, but I read that she left office with a huge deficit of somewhere in the millions of dollars.
I think most of all that is spin. You know, the way she was talking about her record last night was all spun up, and that's just spin coming from the other side. That's just because of bond issues they put out. You know, as local governments all over the country put out bond issues.
And she's really one of her big points is that she is a reformer. And let's take a listen to a bit of her speech last night.
We suspended the state fuel tax and championed reform to end the abuses of earmark spending by Congress. I told the Congress, thanks but no thanks on that bridge to nowhere. If our state wanted to build a bridge, we were going to build it ourselves.
An example to show that she really has taken on Congress, but that's really not the whole story, is it, Steve?
No, that's not really accurate. She sort of implied that they gave the money back to the federal government, and far from that, that project, once they did the engineering on it, had ballooned to an enormous cost just to get across some narrows to the airport. It's not really a bridge to nowhere. It's a bridge to the airport from Ketchikan. But they had to go all the way up the island to get across, to find the spot to get across and keep the shipping channels open. So it became a really expensive project, and it was sucking up, because it was an earmark, was sucking up all the money for all the other highway work in southeastern Alaska, and none of that would have got done. So she just said, well, let's just stop spending on this and put it into these other things that are more needed.
That's pretty interesting, Steve. You know, as a talk show host, and we should say public radio is huge in Alaska, I think what people in the United States who saw that speech last night want to know from you this morning is the woman you saw, the governor you saw on that podium last night, someone familiar to you, or did you see an extreme makeover last night?
A pretty powerful makeover, John. This is by far the best speech I've ever heard her do. This was not. She's not a good public speaker normally, and she was very well coached. She knew when to slow down, when to wait for applause, and she knew how to power home certain selling kind of lines. You know, and. These are not skills we ever saw her show before. So, yeah, she's kind of risen to this occasion, you know. I'm proud of her. I mean, you know, who's not proud to see Mr. Smith go to Washington?
Stephen Heimel, we're definitely going to check in with you. We hope that you'll take our call. We appreciate you joining us this morning.
All right. My pleasure.
Steve Heimel is a senior reporter and producer for the Alaska Public Radio Network, someone who's followed Sarah Palin for some time.
That was really interesting.
John?
We'll shift gears here. There's a meeting going on in Vienna on Thursday and Friday of this week. It's the Nuclear Suppliers Group, and this group is talking about something which actually could be one of the most important legacies of the Bush administration. The Global Nuclear Club, which meets in Vienna today, has to
approve the agreement that was announced in 2005 between the Bush administration and the government of India to sell nuclear goods, civilian nuclear goods. Joining us now is Nathan Hodge, senior writer for Jane's Defense Weekly and also the author of A Nuclear Family Vacation, Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
You're down in Washington. How important, first of all, is this nuclear supplier group meeting?
No, this meeting really is critical. And the heart of the matter really is that India, as a matter of national pride, wants to retain the right to test nuclear weapons at some point in the future, if it so decides. Now, the deal that the United States is pushing for before the nuclear suppliers group does not contain a provision that would basically revoke the agreement to supply nuclear goods and know-how to India if India resumes testing.
So India's understanding is that they're free to test, but according to a secret Bush letter to Congress, it seems that the Bush administration actually has other ideas.
That's the other interesting thing going on down here in Washington. You know, the administration through the State Department has privately assured, you know, Congress through this sort of secret back channel that it would cut off nuclear trade with India if India does test a nuclear weapon. But it's not pushing, it's basically pushing for a waiver that would include no such limitation in these discussions with the nuclear suppliers group.
Well, some of this tough talk made its way back into the Indian press, and I gather there's some criticism of the United States going on in India, which may rock the deal from the other end.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, I also did a quick scan of the Indian press today, and really what they're talking about is kind of what they describe as this non-proliferation lobby, you know, looking to scuttle this deal, which is so key to, you know, Indian national prestige. And it has, I think one of the reasons I think that this Bush letter was withheld, or the State Department letter was withheld, was over precisely concerns that, you know, the Indian government could even could fall if those terms were disclosed.
Hmm. So India has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that is one reason why this agreement and what happens in Vienna this week is going to be very closely watched, certainly by Pakistan, certainly by Iran, probably even by Israel. Is that your view?
Absolutely. And in fact, for the research on our book, we took a trip to Iran last February, and one of the things that did come up in our conversations with Iranian officials was their feeling. Iran, for instance, is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they felt that there was something of a double standard being applied to them. And there's been a lot of saber-rattling over the past few months, both by Israel and the United States, over Iran's nuclear aspiration. Now, Iran has basically said that it seeks only peaceful nuclear know-how. It's not trying to build the bomb. But, you know, there people that we spoke to in Iran said at the same time, if there is a bombing, if there is some kind of military action against Iran, we would withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and there goes all of your international oversight of their nuclear program.
Well, perhaps it was hyperbole, but I said in the introduction that this could be one of the biggest policy legacies of the Bush administration. Fast forward 10 years, how do you think we will view this agreement if it goes through?
Well, look, it really is a massive thing, and I think that it's been covered very closely in the Indian press, but in the U.S., we really haven't heard enough about it. I mean, think back 10 years ago when basically India and Pakistan rocked the entire world by both conducting nuclear tests. 10 years from now, if we look at basically the continuation of basically a nuclear arms race between India and Pakistan, it will have seemed like a missed opportunity. And I think that what's coming back on the radar right now with the current election campaign is this idea that we really, really do need to reinvigorate nuclear nonproliferation. We need to, you know, create more disincentives for countries to go nuclear.
Nathan Hodge, thank you very much. Nathan is a senior writer for Jane's Defense Weekly and the co-author of A Very Nuclear Family Vacation.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. As part of our Republican National Convention coverage, the most important element is you. We want to hear from you. What did you take away from Sarah Palin's speech last night? 877-8-MY-TAKE, or register your comments at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. But video gamers and computer gamers, you know, if they're not in church on Sunday, they're going to be able to stay home and literally play God.
They built starships, and they set out to conquer the galaxy. But what they never realized was that all along the way, from humble microbes to starship captains, someone had guided them at every turn. And that someone is you. Spore, how will you create the universe?
Spore is the latest game from Will Wright, the godfather of simulation gaming, who began with single-player simulations like SimAnt, a simulated ant colony, upgraded that to SimCity, a simulated city, then the multiplayer Sims, which is a simulation of human behavior. Now Spore, which comes out on Sunday, takes it to a whole new level. It's kind of like evolutionary biology meets computer simulation. And addicted to Spore, like millions of others who are anticipating this game, is Dr. Thomas Neer, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Yale University, where he joins us this morning. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Neer.
Good morning.
So you're way into Spore at this point. Explain what it is that you do.
Well, I study the evolutionary biology of fishes, and I study how new species evolve, and we actually go about trying to decipher those patterns as well as describing new species.
And the idea of Spore is that it simulates the entire biosphere. You create organisms, and then they are pitted against other organisms that are created in this new universe and evolve, and it's sort of survival of the fittest?
Yeah, indeed it is. But it's quite a departure from evolutionary biology in that there's really very little population biology, very little natural selection, very little reproduction. It essentially uses themes that you see in many video games, where as you progress through the game, you're able to get more sophisticated body parts, just as in many games, as you progress, you'd be able to get more sophisticated weapons.
So what sorts of organisms have you designed, and what seems to give people an advantage at this point? It's actually sort of hard to know because the game isn't out yet, but there are some clues.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, I've probably played the game, you know, no more than a total of 6 or 7 hours at this point. But essentially, you start off as a single-celled animal, and you could choose whether you're a carnivore or an herbivore, and you float around this primordial soup, and you eat other animals if you're a carnivore, or you eat small single-celled plants if you're the herbivore. And as you eat more and more things, you gain what are called these DNA points, and then you trade them in to get more complex parts.
So very different from Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, very different from Grand Theft Auto, that indeed. But just like in Grand Theft Auto, you have to progress through certain aspects of the game to make it to, you know, the next level. And that's exactly what's happening in Spore. So in a sense, it's very different from the simulation games produced, you know, like the sim games you mentioned before. This definitely is more of kind of a multi-directional scrolling game, and so it's not really a simulation. It's you're essentially going through, adding new parts to this organism, and as you progress, then you evolve in quotes onto as a land-dwelling form, and then you have to have, you know, limbs to move around, and you can essentially trade up ultimately for either wings and ultimately jet propulsion on these organisms. So basically, you're going from the ocean to the land, and it's on the land is where most of the action happens after that.
Well, Dr. Neer, do the organisms take the attributes of the creator in any sense? I mean, is it possible to have a personality in this environment, like say in Second Life, or is it something quite different?
Yeah, as far as I've seen, one could exhibit their personality in terms of the appearance of the organism. There's quite a bit of variation in the body shape and colors and things like that. But it's not quite as anthropomorphic as something like Second Life is.
What is the most unique organism anyone's come up with so far?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to say. The game is populated with literally millions of organisms because EA was very clever in allowing gamers access to Spore through different mechanisms that allowed people to create, to design and make these organisms that then kind of populate the worlds that make up the Spore.
But some of them had to be a little odd or interesting.
Well, yeah,
or...
I mean, they all look strange, but they're all basically, at least the land-dwelling forms that I've run into, are all, limbed organisms. They look like some form of vertebrate, one sense or another. Most of them are what, biologists would call tetrapods in that they have four limbs.
Some of them are actually kind of cute. I mean, that's one of the surprising things.
That's
actually
right.
Cute
that's right.
Little
so there is a lot of cute factor here, too. And what we've seen, just in kind of and working with Carl Zimmer, who wrote the New York Times article that was out on Tuesday, we interacted with some teenagers and younger kids who are playing the game. And one thing I have noticed that appeals to both young boys and young girls.
All right,
and I think, because one could take an aggressive approach and go about and win the game by, killing everything around you. But then again, you could create a cute organism that basically has the advantage by befriending a bunch of other species.
Different ways of thriving in a whole new world. Dr. Thomas Neer, Assistant Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at Yale University, thanks so much.
Thank you, and have a good day.
Dr. Thomas Neer talking about the new game Spore from Electronic Arts, which is released on Sunday. And now, headlines from Femi Ok.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. We have new jobless numbers this morning. Unemployment jumped by 15,000 last week, and that reverses three straight weeks of declines. But the Commerce Department is reporting that productivity is up 4.3% in the second quarter. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin rallied Republicans in her much-anticipated speech on the convention floor yesterday. Palin presented herself as a down-home, tough leader, and she steered clear of the issue of her pregnant daughter and focused instead on attacking Barack Obama. And it's been a few days since Palin introduced us to her family.
Our daughter Bristol, another daughter Willow, our youngest daughter Piper, and over in their arms is our son Trigg, a beautiful baby boy.
Couldn't take my eyes off Trigg last night. The cameras were all over him, as was Piper. She licked her hand, made sure it was good and wet, and then slicked down Trigg's hair just when her mum was speaking. The camera kept on going back to that very sweet moment.
Very adorable. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online, or if that's an invasion of their child's privacy. Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
Ooh, Freakonomics.
Light rock. Less talk.
It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Okay, I'm going to recover. I'm Adora Udoji. And, of course, that would be the new theme song that they cooked up, Dylan cooked up for our friend and pal, Stephen Dubner. He is Jay, our engineer. He cooked this up for Stephen Dubner, co-author of the Freakonomics book and the blog on the New York Times website. And he's been reporting for The Takeaway from the Republican National Convention, as many of you probably know. He's been in St. Paul, but now he's back in New York City. And, Stephen, you interviewed one of John McCain's economic advisors in St. Paul, and you talked to Republican delegates about the GOP platform. But you're a man who spends a lot of time talking to economists, and from what you've gathered, John McCain doesn't like economists very much, right?
Yeah, so I like economists. I like economics. I think it's a useful science, right? But you would think that McCain would be a good economics president because he, like a lot of economists, is kind of a rationalist. He speaks his mind. He's not very PC, right? But you could be forgiven for thinking that he hates them. Here's from a quote from a town hall meeting in New York in June, back during the heated days of arguing over the gas tax holiday. Remember that? Which just about every credible economist in America thought was a ridiculous and ineffective gimmick. Here's what McCain said. He said, "These economists, they're the same ones, I guess, that didn't tell us about the housing subprime lending crisis. They're the ones that didn't tell us about the dot-com meltdown or warn us that inflation's coming up. So I trust the people, not the so-called economists, to give the American people a little bit of relief."
He's mad as hell and not going to take it anymore,
that
as far
is,
as economists are concerned.
He is an anti-economite, as far as I can tell.
And that's interesting he would do that, because he also last year essentially said that the issue of economics is not something I understand as well as I should.
Which would seem to be a weird and glaring admission of a weakness that he wouldn't seem to have. So, you know, it's interesting. Political Scientist is an interesting book out that tries to argue what makes a good president good and why, okay? Because we rate our presidents kind of along very soft lines, soft metrics. And this argument is that good economic presidents tend to come to the job with a big background or at least affinity for business or economics. Last night at the convention.
Or actually a mentor.
Yeah, or at least, right, you have people listen to. Last night, look who we saw speak before Governor Palin was Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina. Those are, you know, there's plainly...
Meg Whitman, the eBay.
Former chairman of eBay, and Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard.
They both bombed, by the way.
I saw Fiorina only. I thought it was, I hate to say, a remarkably bad speech.
That's a whole tangent.
It is a tangent, but it was an interesting
one. But nobody was listening
to
economists in the hall. I mean, it's sort of thematic in the sense that nobody was paying any attention to the economists.
Well, this is true. I asked, yesterday.
While you were also there, though, you got to talk to McCain's top economist.
I did. I asked a fellow named Doug Holtz-Eakin, who is a very well-regarded academic economist and institutional economist, who is now McCain's chief economic advisor. And I asked him, does McCain hate economists the way he sounded like he did in his populist spiel at the town hall meeting? He said, no, he doesn't hate economists. And I laughed when he said that. He said, but I agree that you shouldn't simply listen to economists, because what we say is often too dense, too arcane, and not really actionable enough. That is really the point of conflict here. Political rhetoric and economic analysis are diametrically opposed. One is extraordinarily simple. One is very complex. So,
but you could say that about everything, about foreign policy, about social policy.
You could. I don't know anything about those.
Medicare policy.
I don't know anything about those, so I'm not here to talk about them. But what I do know is that economic policy is a big piece of a government, and it's a big piece of the campaign.
Well, but, you know, FDR had Galbraith. I mean, you could say James Madison had Adam Smith. You could say Ronald Reagan had Milton Friedman. You could even say Clinton had Robert Rubin. I mean, the economists do go along with the policy and actually do have a certain amount of visibility, even if they are arcane.
They have a ton. I mean, the challenge, as Holtz-Eakin told me, is this. It's to take the reality that you know, which is based on empirical work and analysis, give it to your candidate in a way that he can use it to make real good decisions, but not belabor the points that economists tend to belabor all the time. As he said, what economists like to do, what a lot of academics like to do, is argue with each other over the fine points, find the things that they disagree on. That doesn't work well politically.
And you also mentioned another thing, which is to argue against the policy you don't want.
That's exactly right. He said one of the biggest tasks he has is shooting down bad policy. One of the examples of that he gave was this. There was a movement in the McCain campaign to say that all oil that's drilled on U.S. soil should be sold only in the U.S. In other words, let's participate in the free market except when
it
comes to American oil.
And that, of
oil.
Course, is preposterous. Well, then, let's hear the theme again, okay?
Freakonomics.
What is the Freakonomics take on John McCain?
Well,
let's tee it up.
He likes economists fine, and he listens to them hard. So here's the big difference. Last night, if you were watching TV, watching the RNC last night, and didn't know anything about the Republican platform on energy, let's say, you would think it could be reduced to one line, which is this: drill, baby, drill. Right? That was the rallying cry in the hall last night.
A supply side argument.
An extremely narrow supply side argument. Whereas, in fact, the McCain campaign, has this Lexington proposal, which you've probably discussed on this program before. It's an extraordinarily comprehensive and nuanced energy campaign that comprises everything from oil, coal, in many different versions, to Of course, an argument for more nuclear, safer nuclear, alternative energy, and
conservation, windmills, so on.
It's a good
Palin
look.
Essentially laid it out in a sentence or two, but it was not something that was harped on.
No, and won't be.
So here's the takeaway. What you're saying is, as long as the campaign's going on, we're in the freakonomic zone. Once it's over, then we get into the real economic zone.
That's exactly right. Economists are people you want to bury for now, because they're too arcane and analytical sounding, and there's too many if on one hand, on the other hand, and why, you know, Harry Truman said.
But is that true for both parties?
Interesting. We didn't talk about Obama and economics. Obama, who's thought of as so liberal, is a real subscriber to the University of Chicago School of Economic Thought.
Milton Friedman.
Austin Goolsbee, who is a guy I happen to know a bit, and who was one of the chief economic advisors during the campaign. He's not the main guy now. He is a Chicago guy. He is a believer in free markets. Obama, I feel, has been totally misconstrued by the public and the media to some degree. We've been led to think that he is a left-winger economically, that he's a socialist, whereas, in fact, I think he's listening to the University of Chicago ideas much more than people give him credit for.
That's Stephen Dubner. Thank you, co-author of the Freakonomics book and blog. And now we get to Femi Okeh with some headlines.
Thank you very much. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin threw her hat into the ring in a big way last night. John McCain's VP pick attacked Barack Obama. She spoke in glowing terms of her running mate. Palin also talked about her dual roles as a mother and governor. Vice President Dick Cheney is in the Republic of Georgia. He's expressed support for the pro-Western government there. Cheney travels to Ukraine next. The International Monetary Fund says that Iraq's economy, boosted by oil and exports, faces a bright future. The IMF credits increased security and lower inflation. Serena Williams edged out her sister Venus in last night's quarterfinal match at the US Open, and she's going to the semifinals now. And top seed Rafael Nadal played into the early hours of this morning to win his own spot in the semifinals. That's a quick look at your news.
Never count Nadal out, ever. Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji, and I'm John Hockenberry.
No, you're not John Hockenberry, because she's reading the script again. Let's listen to Sarah Palin, for God's sake.
Mr. Chairman, delegates, and fellow citizens, I will be honored to accept your nomination for Vice President of the United States.
Sarah Palin made an historic speech last night at the Republican National Convention, and boy, did she get those delegates going on
she
the
sure
floor
did.
They loved it in St. Paul. But what we want to know is what you think, and here are a few thoughts.
Hi, this is Gail from New York City. Sarah Palin certainly helped make up my mind last night. I am a Hillary Democrat. I was not going to vote for Barack Obama, and Sarah Palin made up my mind. I have to vote for Barack Obama because she is really scary.
Tyrone Thorpe from Baltimore, Maryland. I heard the speech, and I thought it was vitriolic. She did what the VPs have come to do, attack the president on either end. So it's going to be an interesting election, but she came out swinging. I look forward to seeing her and Biden go at it because they're two dogs who know how to fight.
And a fight it will be. Here are two very different takes.
Hi, my name is JJ, and I'm calling from Rockland County. The difference between the coverage and the DNC and the RNC seems to be all a matter of the volume behind the speaker. I listened to Barack Obama, and I could pretty much hear every word he said. And with Sarah Palin, you almost couldn't hear what she was saying because the engineers boosted the audience applause so high it was like some kind of Beatles concert from the 60s.
My name is Nina Spiro. I'm calling from New Rochelle, New York. I loved Sarah Palin's speech last night. I think she gave a big up to women. And as Margaret Thatcher said, if you want something to get done, ask a woman.
lots of opinions people put on our website at thetakeaway.org, including Nancy, who wrote, I think Palin's talent is she's able to read the speech that someone else wrote for her very well. I'm quite sure that she didn't have much to do with writing that speech.
Well, let's hear a few more words from it.
I guess a small town mayor is sort of like a community organizer, except that you have actual responsibilities.
Zach writes on our website, Governor Palin did a better than expected job of pumping up the crowd and came across as a super mom hockey mom. The red flag should be that she spent most of the time since she was announced preparing for just this one speech. The real test is how she can handle some unscripted, tough questions, handle a debate with an experienced senator, Joe Biden, and handle who knows what else will come up from her past in the weeks to come. That says it pretty well. That's Zach.
Yeah, and some people, John, just didn't like the imagery at all.
My name is Audrey from New Hampshire. I think Sarah Palin did an incredible job on her speech. And my concern is I don't know that the U.S. needs a pit bull for a vice president.
Yeah, that was certainly the tagline. And here's Michael from Baltimore.
I didn't think anything about Sarah Palin's speech. I think Americans and these Republicans are trying to hype her up as the next great thing, but she's not. And if she becomes vice president, and woefully, because president, this country is in a world of harm.
Lots of opinions, and we want to hear yours. 877-8-MY-TAKE or
thetakeaway.org. I mean, yeah, I was thinking right there, you know, with all those opinions, particularly the Democrats coming out saying, "Hey, it's no substance here, no substance here." She's really stirred the pot. That speech stirred the pot.
Yes, absolutely did. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We have some headlines for you on this September 4th. Thursday. Femi Okeze to bring them to us. Femi.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. She calls herself part hockey mom and part pit bull. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin went after Democratic challenger Barack Obama last night. At the Republican convention in St. Paul, she knocked him as being inexperienced. Vice President Dick Cheney is condemning Russia for what he calls an illegitimate attempt to redraw Georgia's borders. Cheney told a news conference that the U.S. remains fully committed to Georgia's efforts to join NATO. A hurricane watch is posted along much of the Carolinas as tropical storm Hanna gains strength through the Bahamas. Hurricane Ike and tropical storm Josephine are also gaining strength. Federal mining officials are asking prosecutors whether criminal charges are warranted in the deaths of 9 people in last year's collapse of the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah. And finally, there's a big rock auction going on in London today. Have a listen to this. That's Jimi Hendrix playing Purple Haze, and a little bit of Hendrix is going on sale too. The guitar that he first set on fire back in 1967 is a little bit singed, and it sounds like this. Yes, we could have really done with an amp that morning, but it is going on sale, believed to be worth about $500,000. You can stop playing now.
Could you bring your amp next time?
I will.
Femi, yeah.
I'm not so very good. I need to take more guitar lessons.
Well, thanks very much, Femi. We're going to head back to St. Paul in the GOP convention. Millions of people were watching Vice Presidential nominee Sarah Palin make her acceptance speech on television last night, but apparently also watching on TV were a number of high-profile Republican congressional incumbents and wannabes who decided not to attend the convention. For more on the Republican no-shows, we turn to David Wasserman, a political analyst specializing in the House and the Senate for the bipartisan Cook Political Report. Good morning, David. Who was the no-show and why?
Well, good morning. I think there are plenty of Republican no-shows for one very simple reason. The Republican brand is in the gutter right now, and it doesn't pay to be associated with your party, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, too closely with your party, that is. But I think especially for Republican candidates, it's a real challenge to overcome the perception that you're too closely tied with the past 8 years with President Bush. That's why I think probably more than 30 Republican congressional candidates, candidates for the House and Senate, skipped out on the convention to be back in their districts campaigning and probably being more productive.
David, let's just throw out some names because there really is a list of very high-profile Republicans who didn't make it. I mean, starting, of course, with all of Bush's cabinet. I mean, President Bush made an appearance via satellite. We didn't see Vice President Cheney. You had North Carolina Senator Elizabeth Dole. She wasn't there. Senator John Sununu of New Hampshire, not there. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, not there. Among others, what were some of the reasons that they gave officially?
Well, you had candidates who simply said that they needed to be back in their districts appealing to voters at this time when Congress is not in session, that they needed to spend the time that they had available to communicate directly with their districts rather than being at a party conclave. And I think at this point in the season, that's probably smart. You cited a number of different Senate candidates for re-election, and there were certainly more than a fair share of House candidates as well who were notably absent from this year's convention when otherwise they would be there. I think, for example, Congressman Chris Shays of New York, and of Connecticut's 4th District, which is close to New York, I think he, in particular, is facing a very competitive congressional election and likes to stress his independence from the Republican brand. He's the only Republican member of Congress left from New England out of 20 representatives, and he is currently running an ad saying that he has the penchant for change of Obama with the experience of McCain. I think it's a smart tactic for him, too, to stay away.
Certainly trying to have it both ways. One
sure.
thing that we heard prior to the summer break for the folks on Capitol Hill was that some Republicans felt like it was going to be every person for themselves when they went home and were, stumping for reelection. Has anything happened at the convention this week, you think, to change any of that thought?
No, I don't think so. I think these races are largely playing out independently of what happens at the convention. I think Palin's speech last night, for example, was a real play to the base. And I think Republicans are doing what they can to turn out what has been a very depressed base. I don't think they needed to work on that, though. I think Obama takes care of that. I think Republicans who are very conservative think negatively enough of Obama that they still will get out and vote regardless of how enthusiastic they are for their own ticket. And so whether conservative voters walk or run to the polls, well, mm-hmm. I think last night probably helped them run instead of walk, but they'll still be there.
Very quickly, David, last question. What does the layout look like, the landscape of potential seats that Republicans think they may lose both in the Senate and the House?
Well, the Cook Political Report currently estimates that Democrats will pick up between 4 and 7 seats in the Senate and that they will also pick up between 12 and 17 seats in the House. Neither of those amounts of pickups
right.
gets Democrats to a threshold beyond which Republicans can't stop legislation that they hate with a filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
But that certainly would represent a very, very good night for Democrats.
David Wesserman, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
David Wesserman is an analyst with the Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan publication which is estimating a 4-7 pickup for Democrats in the Senate and a 12-16 pickup in the House. John.
Well, whether predictable or not, from the perspective of an Alaskan, when Governor Sarah Palin took the podium last night, there hadn't been an earthquake of this magnitude in Alaska since the 1960s. And our Ben Calhoun, Takeaway Convention correspondent, has been taking the pulse of the Alaska delegation there in St. Paul. How much excitement and how much reaction have you been able to gather, Ben?
Well, I've met up with a couple of sisters from Alaska. There was Courtney Carlson and Danny Carlson. They weren't delegates, actually, but I spotted them because Courtney Carlson, who's 21, was walking down the street, and she was wearing sunglasses that in rhinestones said Palin across the front. And I thought they were interesting because part of her whole appeal is to youth and to, you know, maybe sort of generate some excitement among young people for the party. They told me that when they found out that Sarah Palin was the VP pick last Friday, they just dropped everything. This is how Courtney described it.
Friday morning, we found out. I got in contact with my sister. Immediately, I started pricing flights. I had to immediately ask my boss how she felt about letting me off. I went looking through every hotel in the area, in the immediate area. Everything was booked solid. We finally found a place to stay. I'm broke right now, but gosh, I felt so strongly to come out and support my governor. I had to scrimp the extra dollars together to come out and support her.
Wow, Palin groupies, and you found them, Ben Calhoun. They must have been thrilled that they actually made it to the speech.
Yes, absolutely. They spent the last few days trying every which way they could to get credentials to get into this building. And right before the speech last night, it looked like only one of the two sisters was going to get in, which would have been a lot of drama. But in the end, they both made it into the building, both saw the speech from inside, and both, you know, they were primed to love the speech last night. But they said that not only did they like it, but they saw it as consistent with the governor that they had seen before. The older sister, Danny Carlson, who's actually reported on Governor Palin in the past, this is how she described her response.
From an Alaskan standpoint, it was really touching to see her represent the state so well and so strongly. I think people underestimated her, and I think she came out swinging. And I think that people are really going to be very impressed by her.
Proud Alaskans talking to Ben Calhoun, one of our takeaway correspondents at the Republican National Convention.
John, I want to let you know that there's lots of ways that you can catch up with us at The Takeaway. You can find us on Twitter, Friend Feed, or Facebook. And on today's show, we're following the reaction to Sarah Palin's speech. And here's what one of you thought.
Andy Roth is my name, South Orange, New Jersey. Well, I thought that Sarah Palin definitely did a great speech, and she's clearly very appealing. I can see why people would totally fall in love with her. I'm a Democrat. I'm hoping they don't fall in love with her too much, and I'm looking forward to the debate.
So are we. And for this hour, here's your takeaway.
It doesn't pay to be associated with your party, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, too closely with your party, that is.
That was David Wasserman, analyst with the Cook Political Report, talking about Republican no-shows at the RNC in St. Paul.
And you can join the political conversation on our website. We're also aggregating, big word there, audio and video from the convention on FriendFeed, friendfeed.com/takeaway.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.